Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Scuttlebutt. I'm your host, Sean Hall, Director of Programming with the Veterans Breakfast Club. We're a nonprofit in Western PA whose mission is to create communities of listening around veterans and their stories to connect, educate, heal, and inspire. You can find out everything there is to know about the VBC on our website, www.veteransbreakfastclub.org. This is the final episode of the current version of the Scuttlebutt, where I would be interviewing and hosting people to talk about military topics, military history, military culture. From here on out, the Scuttlebutt will shift as we will be incorporating the VBC Happy Hour, which we do live every single Monday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. We will be turning that into our podcast. So if you are hearing this episode, know that every episode that follows will be the live broadcast of our VBC Happy Hour. As for this final episode of the Scuttlebutt, I will have on Steve Summers. He is the director, producer, writer of War Movie. You can find it now on Amazon Prime. You can purchase it, a DVD, on Amazon. It is a five-part series documenting the history of war movies in the American cinema from 1900 until now. I have joining me during this conversation my sometimes co-host, Evan Mulgrave, who is a documentarian in his own right. He did the VBC documentary We Left as Brothers, had a fascinating conversation with Steve. We had a great time talking about war movies and war movie history. So I hope that you enjoy this conversation. I hope you enjoy this final Scuttlebutt. Thank you so much for supporting this podcast, and please continue to support it and listen in for everything military culture, military history. Thank you so much again, and I hope that you enjoy the show. And also, like, share, subscribe, ring the bell on YouTube, because we will be releasing episodes every single Monday as we continue on. And make sure you check out War Movie on Amazon Prime. Incredible series. As a movie buff myself, I had a fantastic time watching it. Thank you so much again. Enjoy the show. Joining me now is Steve Summers. You are the director of an upcoming five-part series called War Movie that both Evan and I have had the pleasure and honor of watching. Love for you to introduce yourself. We're so excited to have you a part of the Scuttlebutt. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, no problem. It's great to be here. I've came up with this concept of doing a documentary on the entire, what we call 120-year history of war movies. But I've been in the film business for 20 years, and this has always been something that's kind of been in the back of my mind in some way. And there's been a lot written about it from a scholarly point of view. But there's been nothing put together as far as a kind of visual representation of this history. So I knew there was a lot to explore, a lot of questions to dive into. So it was very fruitful undertaking.
You said 20 years in film, but 120 years to digest of war movies. Where do you start, and you know, what sort of gave you that first inspiration of this is what I want to do?
Yeah, a lot of my projects usually stem from a very personal point of view, or personal experience of some form. So for this, it had to do with just watching these movies, and it was basically watching these movies with my dad. Right. So that experience of like growing up, I'm always kind of being on television of some sort. And, you know, there was always small conversations about, you know, how real something is, how unrealistic it is, or like, that's not what it's like, which I found ironic because my father was never in the military, but he still had those comments of what real war looked like. And I was also a child of the 80s. And so, you know, I grew up with Rambo and Red Dawn and all these very jingoistic, I would say, kind of films. I loved them, you know, growing up. But as time went on, like my views of, you know, history, my views of film have changed and evolved. And, you know, I kind of really wanted to like explore these ideas and these questions that I had about these films. And just how they laid within not only film history, but our country's history, right? Mm-hmm. And how we see history too is also kind of one of the larger elements of the film itself, the doc series.
Yeah, I think that is kind of what I really enjoyed about this series the most, is the way that you were able to structure it both around the shifting tides within the film industry, as well as overall sentiments within the country. That kind of conversation between, you know, how people feel about the war and the type of war films that are being made at the certain time. And I think there is a part where they kind of talk, is that like a chicken or egg type of thing? Is it the war movies that are, you know, telling people how they feel about the war, or is it the war telling people how? And what are your thoughts on that? Do you think it's kind of a two-way street conversation, that those two things can kind of bounce off of each other, or do you think that one kind of has a stronger influence on the popular culture at large, or how they feel about these conflicts?
I think that's something that's changed and evolved, and it really depends on the time you're talking about. So, you know, if you look at World War II, you know, films were being made at that time to get people excited about the war, into, you know, to actually influence them to join and enlist and all that. But then after that, you know, people's memories of the war started to drift away. And you had, maybe in the 90s, you had Saving Private Ryan, where those movies are actually influenced how people remember the war more than actual memories of the time period. So it kind of ebbs and flows as, you know, where we are in history. And it's, there's no one answer. And that's what's kind of fascinating, is that this relationship of like Hollywood and like history has always, they need each other, but they're always at odds with each other in some way. You know, they're always, you know, they're a strange relationship between the two.
As you go back to like the, you know, where your documentary begins in 1900 and the first war films, was it that at that time, were they trying to just entertain and war was just sort of, you know, the best way to do that? Was it, you know, the writers, what sort of like began that genre?
It's just a curiosity. Like, it's still today, right? I think it's still a interest in people seeing these experiences on screen, you know, reenactments of these experiences, these stories on screen. That's kind of been the foundation, and it really hasn't changed a whole lot since, you know, the beginning of film. Film was still new. They were still figuring out how to tell stories and, you know, like, how to present them. But I think for the most part, it was entertaining. It could be even, you know, the first quote unquote war film was the Raising of the Spanish Flag, which is this very silly looking film of a Spanish flag coming down and an American flag going up. But, you know, even that is like a type of propaganda in a way. Like, even the most earliest type of war film had a lean to it. So, you know, it always was entertainment, but it was also, you know, there was also something to be said too.
One of the things that I found interesting that I learned from the documentary is how many of, it seems like, the early Hollywood war films were by people that served, you know, whether it be, you know, like Audie Murphy being you know, the star of these films, or certain directors and writers that would come back from the war and be able to write about their experiences. Do you feel, as you know, we move further along and there is kind of that larger divide between the people who serve and the general population, do you think that has influenced how these films look, feel, just your thoughts on that? That it seems like earlier on, those films had more firsthand influence by people that served in these conflicts compared to where we are now.
Sure. Yeah. I think there's a lot less of that now, although it tries to, you know, there are directors that have served who are trying to get their voices out there. I think it's tough now because we have 100 years of war films that we've seen, and that's almost the greatest influence more than experience. And so, you know, like a lot of the people I talked to were like, well, what influences directors are the other war films, not actually the wars themselves, right?
Yeah.
Because they want to create something that is familiar to people to a degree, right? So they kind of have to go on, you know, like, you know, the stereotype of the genre and things like that. It's, you know, it's rare that you get those films that are really break the mold, right? From a veteran experience, you know. And they're, you know, they're being made, and they're few and far between, but it's a risk for a studio to do that, to put something different out there. And I think that's a whole art, you know, another discussion of itself, is like the studio influence on like what gets made and what doesn't, you know, as far as like getting behind a veteran story, right? So.
What would you say in that sort of vein, but like who has told maybe like the most pure veteran story? Because if you have veterans telling it, is it a more pure story that way? Or have you found that in watching all these films, like someone who isn't a veteran may be able to shed different light on that?
That's a difficult thing to say. I think there's nuances that play into a film made by a veteran. There's little things that another director may not see as important or just brush over. The one thing I heard a lot of, veterans talk about is just the boredom, right? The boredom of warfare or the military experience. And, a conventional director probably would try to get rid of that as much as possible. But I think a veteran may be like, no, that's a big part. In fact, that's most of it, right? Mm-hmm. So in some ways, I think like those little things like boredom or just doing daily tasks are very important as far as showing what the military experience is like. But there are, filmmakers like Oliver Stone with Platoon who really like changed the game, and that's a different type of movie than what we saw before. And I think, once in a while you'll get those directors that really bring the boots on the ground, no pun intended, to the project and really can shake it up and make it the way they think it should be seen, Mm-hmm. I think it takes two things. I think it takes a veteran, but I also think it takes a good director, right? You can't just have one and not the other. I think, you have to have both.
Or veteran advisors, maybe, like as we saw.
Yeah, that's a big thing too, and the willing to listen to those guys too, and not, succumb to the, what may be more entertaining or, pleasing to the audience, right? Really, mm-hmm. Showing it the way it is. So, I mean, as far as that single film that like is the ultimate, I don't know. I'm not a veteran, so I can't even really speak to that. I feel weird talking about that, but I mean, there are certain films that really, you hear veterans speak of quite a bit, like, Saving Private Ryan or Platoon or, even like Black Hawk Down, which was not made by a veteran, but there was a lot of, guys that were there involved in Somalia that were part of that film. So it really has that kind of characteristic to it.
One of the things that I found really interesting is how quickly certain sentiments could change within the country in regards to how they take these films in, the type of sentiments that are in the films themselves. Like I think one of the most stark is, end of World War II, right into the Cold War. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that, of those times, how quickly things shift, and what do you think are some of the reasons for that? And also, how does the industry respond in those types of situations? Like one of the most stark, I was talking to Sean about it, was like, having someone like Dalton Trumbo write kind of like a rah, rah, rah World War II picture, and then, also write Johnny Got His Gun. And
right.
How those sentiments change the way we look at these films and how these films are made.
Yeah, I mean, coming out of World War II, that shift, going into the Korean War and then Vietnam, I don't think it's as quick as we think it was. I think, it took a long time and a lot of, I don't want to say the failure of the Korean War, but the social questioning of the Korean War, or the like misunderstanding of the Korean War, and I think like the just how the people saw the the Red Scourge and going after communism and all that is not a as clear cut of a war, the Cold War, as it is like going after the Nazis. And so like it's drawn out, it's a long time, it's not defined, we're going after people in our own country. And so it becomes like this whole different thing. And so I think, people's attitudes started to change because of that. And, I just think people, after years of being preached, with the World War II movies, you start to get veterans that actually came home and told their experience and told, you know, like those movies weren't the, you know, ideal of what war is like. And so you start to get truth coming out and it's wakens people up to what's going on. And so, but Hollywood at the end of the day is there to make money. So, you know, they're going to go whichever way the wind blows. There are, like I said, there are times when you have a director come out and make something that is like, you know, going against the grain of saying whatever the grain is at that time, right? I think it's challenging for like directors to come out and have films that are truly original, speaking to whatever, you know, they want to say as far as, you know, what they see as the war experience. I think it's very difficult for them.
Where did you see those types of shifts happen as you developed the series? Was it always a 5-part series that you were planning, or did it sort of become that? And did you see that these, like, did you see patterns emerge as you started putting it all together?
Yeah, it was originally supposed to be just 1.5-hour, 2-hour documentary, but then it just kind of like grew, you know, like history, I couldn't contain it in 2 hours. And so it became 4 hours and then it became 5 hours. But, yeah, because, you know, the story needs to be told as a complex thing. It can't be just simply laid out as, you know, in a 2-hour thing. Or, I mean, it wouldn't be fair. It wouldn't be fair to the subject matter to put it in 2 hours. So, you know, I really wanted to get I wanted to get into these questions, and I can only do that in a 5-hour format. And I think they deserve that time to explore. I think it's, you know, again, unfair to go through them quickly. But, you know, like that, you talk about patterns. I don't know if there's patterns. I see it as like an evolution, more or less, right? You know, going from like, you know, Silent Days to World War II to like, you know, post-World War II. And that changing attitude of film, how we see history, I think really is what motivated me to drag it out to the 5 hours, is because like, oh, there is so many nuances in here that we can see of today happening back then, and like how we could learn from that.
What would you say was the biggest leap during that century in technology that really pushed this genre forward? Was it Technicolor? Was it sound? Was it, you know, special effects?
Sound is the underrated, you know, champion of filmmaking. People don't understand that, like, without sound, it's, you know, that's half of what you're experiencing, right? So I think sound is a massive, massive change, right? Color is important, but it's not as important as people think it is. I think CinemaScope, or like, you know, Panavision, whatever you want to call it, was important only because it was battling television, you know, in some ways, you know, that's why that was created, you know, just for commercial reasons. But those are the big things. I think you don't really see a major technological shift until you get into like, you know, the turn of, you know, the 21st century, where you start to get digital technology and you can start to see even newer things coming about. So, but I think sound, I mean, you know, and even up to like Saving Private Ryan, you know, I mean, people notice the sound in that film, right? Mm-hmm. And that's like, you know, 70 years after the creation of it. So it's still important.
Something that is touched on early on in the documentary, and I think it's a quote from Truffaut, where he said, "There's no such thing as an anti-war film." is that something that you agree with after looking at all these films?
That depends on the person. You know, people can take anything and see anything in it. Growing up, I'll use the movie Red Dawn, even though it's fictional. To me, it was exciting. It was about, you know, I don't know, preparing for this thing, you know, the red invasion of, you know, sorts. But I watch it now and I see it completely differently, as kind of like a warning to maybe, you know, what we, you know, the direction we're going as a country, or relations we're having with Soviet Union. But I think most directors and most veterans want to put across the idea that, you know, this is a warning, right? All war films should be a warning, even though if they're a story of heroics and stuff, at the end of the day, they should be a warning of we need to avoid this as much as possible. But there's also this thing of where, like, innately, warfare is exciting on screen, right? And so mm-hmm. you have this, you know, again, very interesting conflict of things of like, no, you know, we shouldn't do this. We shouldn't, you know, try to, you know, get our nation to do this. But hey, do you want to watch this? You know, like this horrible violence, right? So mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's a genre that's always in conflict with itself in a very weird way, right?
Mm-hmm. What I found really interesting is I never had thought about it until really watching through the documentary was, you know, we have tons of World War II films, and part of that is the propaganda, like you mentioned, trying to get people to enlist. But as you get into sort of the obscure of Korea, we're not really knowing what the war is about in Vietnam, I didn't ever put two and two together that the reason there may not be as many of those films is because they were a bit confusing, that we didn't have a clearly defined, you know, good versus evil. We had the, you know, communism, but we were also still questioning why we're in Vietnam. In addition to that, also that everybody had a TV and we were seeing the war every night. So we didn't need to go to the cinema to watch it. And I found that to be really interesting that the American public and how Hollywood sort of understood that and how they dealt with it, you know, in those eras and what films they were willing to produce. But then after we got through a certain amount of time, then things like Platoon can be released because people wanted to go and watch a movie about that war that really they just experienced.
Yeah, to me, that the Vietnam era is by far the most fascinating because it's really the sea change of the country as far as, you know, television's coming into home, right? As a country, we become more media savvy. We're aware of what we're watching is not just, you know, all reality, you know, we see behind the curtain, so to speak, right? And so, yeah, you start to see, you know, Hollywood trying to keep a distance, like, you know, part of, you know, John Wayne wanted to, you know, he created Green Berets and he wanted to play the traditional game, but that didn't, you know, didn't catch and people didn't, you know, it was successful, but, it, you know, people didn't get behind it like they did, you know, like the stuff in W2. So you start to see this real, like, we don't know what to do. There's a real confusion about like, how do we explore this thing? And how do we address audiences that are actually split in the country? And they didn't, you know, they just avoided it for, you know, during the war itself. It was just like, you know, nobody wanted to take it on because they thought it'd be a failure. And to me, that kind of, that sea change of the country is interesting because, you know, I feel like we're maturing as a country, right? We're coming out of World War II, which was, you know, a very necessary war, very clearly defined. And we're coming to something that's a lot more gray, right? People are starting to like, figure out, you know, trying to figure out their position on everything. And, you know, you see this older generation and this newer generation coming in conflict. And so to me, it's, you know, it becomes far more interesting as a social kind of experiment, you know, how films play in that time period. Mm-hmm.
I also think it's interesting too, from the filmmaker point of view of that time period as well. It's, you know, the 70s is often looked at as maybe the most artistically robust time, that filmmakers had much more freedom to be able to make the type of films. Kind of the old guard of the studio system had fallen away after the 50s. So they were taking risks on, you know, this young batch of filmmakers. And it's hard to imagine a studio making something like Deer Hunter today about one of the conflicts. And what are your thoughts on that as well? Just maybe how the market pressures of the different time periods and especially today, do you think that affects how, you know, we may have not gotten that kind of generational post 9/11 war movie like we did for Vietnam or World War II?
Yeah, you know, as far as the current place where we're at, I still think there's going to be a film going to be made about, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq or those conflicts that's going to be just great, you know, just something that's really going to break the mold and say things that hasn't been said yet. I think it's very difficult now for filmmakers because of just you know, how Hollywood is set up and, you know, the willing to take risks. The 1970s were a very unique time of, like, you know, the studio system, like you said, just ran out of steam. It wasn't working anymore. And these young voices were coming up and they just plowed ahead and kind of made these movies, and the young people generation reacted. You don't have that same type of film audience anymore now. You know, you don't, you know, we have so much visual media influencing us from so many directions, right? Podcasts, and, you know, YouTube, that to have that kind of, like, you know, momentum behind one film is kind of, would be very difficult now. I'm not saying it's not possible. I mean, we had Barbie and Oppenheimer become like this crazy giant, you know, sensation. Doesn't have to do with war, but it kind of shows it can still happen, right? But I think you really would need a director out there that would really, like, want to roll the dice, you know? I mean, I still see the stuff coming out about Iraq and Afghanistan is pretty tame, you know, as far as, like, saying something new and different and trying to shake up the establishment. Or traditions, I guess, in some way.
Yeah, it seems to me, and I'm a little bit more aware of the more recent movies to come out. Even I think there's a recent Jake Gyllenhaal movie that came out about an interpreter that he was with, and like what it even is trying to say there of just, like, you know, we need to back up our interpreters, but not saying anything really big or really different about what these wars were. You know, it doesn't give us that cultural shift that we saw.
Yeah, I think there's a real, I mean, you know, it's funny coming out of Vietnam, you know, there's the Vietnam syndrome of, like, you know, the question I think a lot of directors have is, like, how do you support the troops? How do you show you support the troops, not question the country, but also show the war? And so, you know, sometimes they're always trying to do all three of those things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think they're afraid to challenge one of the other, right? But sometimes these earlier 70s films did. They really, like, questioned, you know, why we were there, all of that stuff. So I think they're trying to, you know, answer to too many masters in that way. And I think if you're going to be, you know, if you're going to be make something good, you really have to have a one direction in it and kind of move forward with that.
Evan, you had mentioned before that you were sort of you liked the film industry history. And and you said, like, yeah, we have documentaries about all these horror films and how those have developed over the years. has the war movie genre helped push Hollywood forward more so than maybe other genres have?
I mean, I think they have. I mean, you look at in every era of these films, you see great masters making them. You know, you don't see that with every other genre.
True.
You know, the early years, you have, you know, guys like John Ford. In the 70s, you have Coppola. You know, even into the 90s, you have Spielberg. You know, so I think that the war movie does help push film forward and these new innovations, mostly because of the talent that they attract. You know, these you know, like, American masters that really want to be able to put their stamp on not only that genre, but what the genre lends you to be able to say, I think.
I also think there's it's a, you know, a notch in your belt to make a war movie, right? That's the whole thing, is like, okay, I'm ready to make my war movie, right? Christopher Nolan with Dunkirk, I mean, he waited a while and then he's like, it's time, I do this, you know? And it's like, that's totally different than Batman or all the other stuff. It was like, he wanted to do that. And I think for some reason, directors want to take on that, like, just massive, you know, storyline and political storyline that war entails. And it's, you know, it's challenging and it's like, it's large, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not a romantic comedy.
It's like King Henry in a way, Shakespearean. Like,
it is. It deals with so many extreme things that, you know, it's seductive. You know, why wouldn't you want to, you know, try it, you know? Because your filmmaking is exhausting, right? It requires so many resources. And to recreate a war is like the ultimate version of that, right? Whether, you know, even if you're doing it digitally, it's still like a mass amount of work. So, you know, it's, I think directors see it as a challenge, and it's, you know, they're attracted to that. Yeah.
And it was a massive amount of money in certain eras when they would film these battles, because it wasn't like Troy where you can CGI some of this, these thousands of soldiers. Back then they would, put the camera up on a crane and have 1,000 extras running at each other, it
Yeah,
seemed.
they would get military. They go off to some other country and hire their military to like dress up in costumes and represent, whatever it may be, Napoleonic Wars or what have you. So yeah, I mean it's there's a little bravado in that, a little chismo, but I think that's what makes films great sometimes, the willingness to like let's do something that's never been done before,
We both, Evan and I, love the experts that you brought on to talk about this subject, and an expert yourself. What when in going into this, when you first started producing it and directing it, writing it, what was the thing that you thought you knew most about the war film genre that you learned later that kind of changed your mind? What was maybe the biggest thing you learned during the making of this?
I mean, the deeper you dive into something like this, there's just nooks and crannies that it's always surprising. But honestly, the best thing hearing was the veteran experience from the different guys I talked to, that had, that were either involved in filmmaking in some way or film history in some way, and just how they saw these things and how, these things represented their experience. And how they see them today, do they still watch these films? Do they enjoy them? Do they not enjoy them? And I still like talking to veterans about that because to me, that's like, there is no other genre that does that, right? There's no other, like, horror is awesome, I guess. I'm not a horror guy, but like, there's nothing else it takes from a personal experience and, attracts people as much as war films. And so, I've talked to some veterans that are just love them and watch them still, even though, they've gone to battle and whatnot. And some that are just, they don't want to waste their time on it because it's not so much about bringing bad memories up sometimes. It's just like, that's not how it is. And you can never recapture that on screen. And so to me, that kind of like span of interest or disinterest is very unique. And I really enjoyed talking to those guys about it.
What are some of your personal favorite war movies and why?
I was going to say by era. I wrote that down because by era, I was like, well, if I was going to narrow it down per era, like, what should I focus in on?
I mean, what I love, I'll do by era. Silent film's a little tough, because, of course they're the great ones, but I think when you look at the silent World War I films, like The Big Parade, it's pretty amazing. Because it is such an anti-war film. It's big, it's beautiful, it's there's a love story, but there's also about trauma. So like even early on, we were really trying to get to the bone of what warfare was and how we're attracted to it. But these guys and ladies come home and then they're scarred by it. So in some ways, once I saw that, I was like, oh, nothing's changed. We're just repeating the story for new wars over and over again. So to see that like built right out of the gate, or pretty early out of the gate, was pretty amazing, right? All Quiet, the first All Quiet was really good. I think as far as the World War II films, it's hard to tell because some of them are so, propaganda-ish. But I would say the Red Badge of Courage, it's not about World War II, but I think, John Huston coming back from experiencing World War II, I mean, that's amazing to me. Like Audie Murphy, you can see him really suffering from the experience, even though he's not, playing the war he was in, And to me, that has such a contemporary weight to it that I think it's a shame that film got cut down because it really is kind of beautiful and very heartfelt and very, says a lot about, the battle and the experience of PTSD. I love Apocalypse Now, of course. I'm a big fan of, I think Black Hawk Down is one of the most amazing films ever made because kinetically, there's nothing like it. It's just, it's a mess, but it's like so beautifully put together. I think that's one of my favorites. But it's also funny because I come from like more of an art house kind of world. So films like The Thin Red Line, I'm very much into. I know some people don't prefer that, but yeah, it depends on my mood, what I'm really into, you know, like sometimes I want just the straight standard thing. And sometimes I want something a little more creative.
The Thin Red Line was kind of like we were discussing earlier, like that one was a quiet war movie, if I remember correctly. And it came out during the time of Saving Private Ryan. So it didn't get as much press at that time, right?
Right. Yeah. They came out the same time. They're both about World War II, one in the Pacific, one in the, you know, European front. And they're just complete opposites as far as like how to approach filmmaking, right? And both are valuable. I mean, Saving Private Ryan is a masterpiece, but to me, so is Thin Red Line, just in a different way. And, you know, depends what you want out of it, but, you know, they both have value, and I both watch each one on a regular basis because they both kind of say something in a different way.
How much do you think?
Yeah, Matt.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Evan.
Terrence Malick's approach to a war film is, you know, his approach to film in general. One of the famous stories is that, you know, Adrian Brody was under the impression that he was the lead in that film. And you know, yeah. Terrence Malick just shoots and shoots and shoots to, and he kind of finds it in editing and, you know, Adrian
sometimes
Brody
it works, sometimes it doesn't.
That is true. I think it does work in Thin Red Line. He's giving an interview at Cannes and people are asking him, so what movie are you here for? He's like, well, I'm the star of this one. And they're like, you're barely in it.
Yeah. I mean, Malick's a whole, you know, I could talk about him all day, but yeah, it's a certain type of, you know, more of a thinking film. It connects, you know, very much philosophical ideas and, you know, it's not really concerned with telling you the war experience as you traditionally know it. He's kind of going for bigger questions outside of just the box of the war itself, the historical war itself. And I know sometimes, like, you know, when people go to see war films, they just want to see the war. And to me, I'm interested in the bigger questions. So that movie really speaks to those bigger questions.
So realism, that was the question I'm about to ask. Realism doesn't necessarily need to be top in the most focused thing for a war film to be accurate. Like, and I mean realism as in a veteran will go sit down and say the stripe is wrong on the shirt, or you know, even like the gore element of just like, you know, if someone has their arm, you know, taken off, like how much do we really need to see that? And it seems like Saving Private Ryan, like as an example, got a little bit of flack from that in a way because it was quite gory, but there was also like D-Day was pretty terrible. So how much of that realism needs to be in film for us as the audience to really even remotely understand what it was like to be there?
I think I generally don't need the violence. I think for me, creative filmmaking is about other things. If you want the war experience, I think this, again, this is from what I've heard, talked about people, is way more complicated than just seeing a guy's arm blown off. Like there's so many, you know, little factors of, you know, what that is. And to me, if you can walk away, if the director can make you walk away with whatever they have their intention is, whether, you know, war is terrible or, you know, the story of this person being this great hero, then they've succeeded. It's when they start to get into gore and stuff like that, as far as like, it's to like, you know, to fill in the blanks because the story they have is weak and they're, you know, they're trying to juice it up to fill in, you know, whatever they're lacking in the other parts of the story. So to me, war has that stuff and it needs to be there to some extent, but that shouldn't be why we go to war films.
Yeah, I remember during the documentary, it was highlighted at one point, I can't remember what film it was, but the gentleman rushed an enemy position and picked up a half of a body to use it as an armor or like a shield. And they were like, you know, in a war film, suddenly that just takes you out of the whole thing. And you're like, wait, like, this seems completely unrealistic now, and now you've lost me as an audience member in a way.
Yeah, that was Hacksaw Ridge.
Hacksaw Ridge, yeah.
A great story, and actually a great movie, you know, with the exception of that part, about a great man. But yeah, it's just, you know, and that's increased through history, right? That's become something that's more and more like we feel like we need to have it in our stories. Again, look at, you know, Dunkirk by Christopher Nolan. I don't think there was hardly any blood in there. And that's a, you know, incredible film, you know. So, it's an excuse as far as I see it as a creative filmmaker.
And it seems like things have shifted in a sense. If you bring up Christopher Nolan and like the idea of like Dunkirk was very different than Batman, but it's also made the argument in the documentary that like our superhero movies now sort of taking over that the war film genre. Like now we need, and I remember hearing that said, it was like now we need our soldiers to be super soldiers, and now we need to have like bigger battles against, you know, aliens, because maybe telling a personal story of a soldier in Vietnam is not what the audience is currently looking for.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we've gone this way is pretty complicated. I think it primarily has to do with I think the Iraq and Afghanistan wars were so, you know, complicated and gray, and they went on for a long time that, you know, we were looking for simplicity. We're looking for, you know, I mean, we even went back to World War II films, but we can only do that for so long. And so we, you know, superheroes are black and white. We can go that direction. And so I think, you know, they kind of filled in that gap of what we needed, or we felt we needed, you know, as far as the kind of, you know, good guy versus bad guy scenario. So that's why I think they're there for the most part.
Mm-hmm. And going back to what you were talking about with kind of that tension between creating this, you know, quote unquote, realistic experience towards maybe a creative taking bigger risks that fall outside of, you know, what actually happened or how it, you know, felt or how it was in order to be able to make a statement. Do you think that is something that may be holding back the post 9/11 war movies as well? Because there feels like because we experience so much of it on television, you know, you can look at, you know, footage online from soldiers and things like that, that it feels like those movies are very deferential to realism and maybe not trying to say as much. Do you feel that way at all?
Yeah, I think, yeah, we're exposed to so much that I think it's difficult to tell a true story, an accurate story, but also sometimes to be truly creative at the same time. So I think there's a conflict there a bit. You know, like the recent successful war films like Dunkirk, 1917, and All Quiet on the Western Front, they're pretty accurate, but they're also pretty creative too. They take really different approaches to things that we've seen before, you know, how things are, you know, have been said in the past. And I think there just needs to be the Iraq-Afghanistan version of those films where somebody's willing to, you know, it's never going to represent the soldier's experience. Like Apocalypse Now is, you know, people talk about like that's nothing what it was like, but yet it just was so saturated in like the feeling of it. And so what, you know, one of the scholars said in the doc is like, what's more important, the feeling or the historical accuracy? You know, that's something that's up for debate and will continue to be debated till the end of time. To me, it's about the feeling. That's why we go to the movies. Like if you want to learn about the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, pick up a book, you know, or talk to a veteran, right? But if you want to maybe get close to what that experience was like, or, you know, the country's feelings at that time or something like that, that's why we go to movies. We shouldn't go to movies to get history, you know, in of itself. It should be the experience.
Is that where you see war films going in the future? If we go 10, 20 years down the line, obviously there'll be more conflicts and more different things to create storylines about. But do you think they're all in the next like 20 years probably going to reflect on the war on terror? Or as it's been sort of cyclical, we're going to get these 1917s, these, we have a leap in technology, so let's recreate All Quiet on the Western Front and, you know, bring it up for modern audiences.
I think you're always going to go back to the past. That's always going to be something that's going to be redone, and you know, that's where which is interesting, where some of the, I think, the more inventive films, like I said recently, have come from looking in the past, even like 100 years into the past. We're really, you know, coming up with stuff from that. You know, I think, like somebody said in the documentary, I think the series is going to be played out more. We just had Masters of the Air come on Apple, which is, I think, doing pretty well. So, you know, maybe in that direction, maybe more creative ways other than just the 2-hour film, you know, maybe other ways I don't know about yet. But I do hope there is something about the Iraq and Afghanistan war that, you know, filmmakers will try to really creatively and, you know, invest themselves in and really come up with a unique story. But we'll see. We'll see.
When you look at other documentaries, like, let's say, Restrepo, mm-hmm. you know, these are much more zeroed in and more specific about, like, what's going on in these particular conflicts. Did you take into these ideas of these documentaries into account in sort of your sort of breadth of this, the war movie documentary series?
No. Simply because, I mean, it's funny because when you start making a documentary, you have to put limits. That's the most challenging thing, is you have to say, well, you know, what are we going to talk about? Maybe this, but not this, and this, and not that, simply because you can't explore everything. You know, if I started to talk about the history of war documentaries, I mean, that's another 5-hour film there, right? Mm-hmm. And they have been, you know, like Five Came Back. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that. But yeah, about the directors that went over in World War II. Some of that stuff's been explored. But, you know, like films like Restrepo, I love, and I think that's great, but it's like I had to narrow it down. I wanted to do fictional films. And I just did American films too. I didn't even get into like world cinema, which is a whole, like, you know, that's another 10 films maybe, right?
Yeah. I was going to sort of ask about that because it seems like, I mean, so much of cinema comes out of America. And where are the other sort of war films internationally, the most famous international war films?
They're out there. I mean, you know, America's always been tough to let in other countries' films. You know, we have a problem with subtitles here. So, you know, there have been great, great war films made in other countries. Come and See is one that I, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever seen that. It's pretty fantastic. It's a Russian film. But there have been, you know, many that just don't get the play that they do in other countries, you know? So, which is a real shame because there's some really great ones out there. I think Netflix and, you know, the streaming platforms are starting to break that down. I think we're starting to see a lot more people taking on international films more than they did in the past, you know? So, you know, maybe there's another documentary out there on that. So we'll see.
Going to kind of talking about that, like international war films, you know, you mentioned Come and See, which is like this brutal sort of look at war. How do you see the American war films compared to international war films? Do they similarly have a sense of like rah-rah patriotism that Americans do, or is that something unique within the Hollywood system?
I think it depends. I think in other countries, they tend to be more critical of themselves, even, you know, judging who they are. That depends on the country too. You know, some are more open to be critical of their own actions and some are not. So, you know, specifically the Soviet Union, there've been a lot of like, you know, pro-Soviet films made, but there's also been like, you have these directors that slip out of the system, so to speak, and make these very brutal, you know, films. Tarkovsky's another one that made one called Ivan's Childhood that's very critical of the war experience. And so it really depends on the country, you know. Great Britain, for example, has a lot of very rah, rah, rah stuff, you know, out there, but they become critical too. So, I mean, the thing with American films is that our films bleed everywhere, or they go into everything, or everybody sees them. So their influence is so heavy and so powerful that, that was another aspect that was important to me, is like, not only are we making these films for ourselves, but this is how other people are seeing how we see ourselves. So, you know, what does that mean, right? How do we view our own conflicts, and how do we, you know, what do they say about us?
Well, certainly movies like Rambo, that's like not necessarily giving us the best light. It's saying like, oh, we're the cowboy. We're going to go in and one man army is going to take everybody out and save the day.
Yeah. It hasn't always been a good representation of who we are as a, you know, a country, or, you know, the majority of people or the minority of people. So, mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that's interesting, to seeing that like kind of ebb and flow again of like, you know, how we represent ourselves.
Or you could look at something like Top Gun, which, I mean, was massively successful and drove enlistment numbers way up in this incredible sort of collaboration between Hollywood and the military. Do you see in the future like more collaborations between Hollywood and the military, such as Top Gun? I mean, even Top Gun Maverick had that probably that same level.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I maybe it's hard to tell because, you know, all the great war films, I will say, maybe with the exception of Black Hawk Down, have been made outside of the military's using the military, right? The process is you got to submit a script to the military, to the government. They go through, if they like it, if it shows that the military in good light, then they'll, you know, lend you support. But if you're being critical of the military in any way, they're not going to, you know, you can't borrow a Black Hawk helicopter if you're going to shit on us. So, you know, I think there will be some films like that. But I think if you're going to have a like honest critique of warfare, I don't think it's, you know, you're not going to get that, right? I mean, Top Gun Maverick was great, but it doesn't say anything about the military or conflict, really. That's a, you know, it's just sexy planes and stuff. So, but which is great, you know, I mean, it that's what it went out to do, and it succeeded. So, you know,
that was their goal.
That's their goal, man.
Yeah, I guess just on the future of the war film, you know, obviously the Vietnam War films came out in a time where things were very politically divided. We're at a very politically divided place now. And kind of you talking about the Marvel movies taking over for the war film, I think that there's, you know, an uncoupling of politics that the Marvel movies are able to serve that like thrill, but not make you think about what these conflicts mean. What do you see that as a challenge going forward for making the next great war movie, or and do you think that perhaps if a war movie that came out that was able to tackle those feelings, would it be able to find an audience with the way that we are currently?
I'd like to think so. The one thing I will say about this is when you have, you know, there are trends in Hollywood or the history of film is like when you have too much of something, there's always a reaction in the other direction, right? And that's my hope with the Marvel movies. Like, I like the Marvel movies as much as the next person, but my hope is that they cause a reaction, and I think we're starting to see it in filmmakers, to you say, I don't want to do that. I want to make something that says something, really, truly something unique and, you know, from the soul, and they'll go forward. And people are getting tired of this stuff. They're tired of the same repeated storylines, you know? So I think audiences will want that eventually, you know? I think it's difficult now because of streaming and, you know, all of our media devices to find that concentration of getting everybody to look in the same direction, so to speak. I think it's a miracle that Barbie and Oppenheimer were as big as they were. That was like a weird confluence of things, right? Mm-hmm. Can a war movie ever do that again? I don't know. There's so many factors involved with it now. I mean, it's a lot more complicated than it ever has been. So it's like, it'll be interesting to see which way the wind blows. But I'm hoping that filmmakers do that.
Your 5-part documentary, war movie, when is it releasing and how will people be able to watch it?
You can purchase it now on Amazon, stream it through Amazon Prime. You can also get the DVD and Blu-ray through there. We're also looking for another home, so keep your ears peeled. We're hoping to get it on another streaming platform. So, yeah, it's out there now.
Excellent. We will provide a link down in the description for anybody watching or listening. Check it out. Evan, I know I won't speak for you, but personally, I loved it. You'd mentioned that you really enjoyed it. So please, if you're listening or you're watching, check out War Movie, the 5-part documentary, and watch the whole thing, because there's so much that I learned from beginning to end that I had no idea about in the film industry, how it developed, you know, what was being said, the propaganda. And as I mentioned to Evan, that Hollywood kind of got a bad rap, that they sort of said, okay, we'll create all this propaganda. And then the government was like, well, you're all commies, so we're going to come after you now. there's a whole bit of drama. It's almost, it's own movie, just watching it. Evan.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic project. If you're a war movie fan, it's definitely worth a watch. If you're just a film fan in general, interested in certain movements within film history, it's worth a watch. And fantastic project. I highly recommend checking it out.
Thank you,
Steve. I want to give you the final word here, but what do you hope that somebody takes away from watching this series?
As a filmmaker myself, my big thing is about opening up dialogue. And dialogue between people and ideas. And, you know, information is good, but it shouldn't just stop there. It should, you know, make you start to question what you see, question, you know, not question the veteran experience, but maybe become interested in it more. It's just how all these things kind of interact. And that was one of my goals with the film, is not only to show the history of this stuff, but people that have been there through their own veteran experience, how they react to these movies, and, you know, maybe how we should see them in the future.
Excellent. Well, to our audience, please like, share, subscribe, ring the bell on YouTube so you're the first to know whenever the Scuttlebutt releases new episodes. You can always reach out to me, Sean, Shaun at veteransbreakfastclub.org, with any thoughts or comments, questions. I would love to have you back on, Steve,
sure.
In the future. That'd be great to catch up with you again. Evan, I want to thank you again for co-hosting this episode of The Scuttlebutt. And to our audience, watch out for more episodes in the future. We're grateful for the support of UPMC for Life, a UPMC healthcare Medicare program. At UPMC Health Plan, their goal is to improve the health of their members. They can also help you make sense of Medicare, get the answers and information you need, such as how to choose the Medicare Advantage plan that's right for you. UPMC for Life offers a wide range of affordable Medicare Advantage plans, and you military veterans can save money and get more benefits with your Medicare plans. UPMC for Life has plans designed for veterans by veterans. The type of coverage you have from your service may help you decide which plan will be a good fit. If you have TRICARE for Life, UPMC for Life PPO Salute may be a good fit for you. You can view plan options, including their prescription drug coverage, compare costs, and learn about all the benefits you get when you choose UPMC for Life by going to upmchealthplan.com/Medicare. Thank you so much, UPMC for Life, for sponsoring the Scuttlebutt. Thank you for watching this episode of The Scuttlebutt. I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Tobacco-Free Adagio Health. Tobacco-Free Adagio Health has been supporting the podcast for quite some time now. We've been so pleased to be supported by them. They are dedicated to reducing and preventing tobacco use and getting the word out about the hazards of smoking and secondhand smoke. They're all about health, so they want people to quit. They have classes, nicotine replacement therapy, and a popular quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They also educate people, children especially, about tobacco use, from cigarettes, cigars, pipes, chew, snuff, and other nicotine products like vaping. And finally, Tobacco-Free Adagio Health advocates for public and private policies that ensure healthy places to live, work, and play. You can learn all about what Tobacco-Free Adagio Health offers at tobaccofree.adagiohealth.org, or you can check out the 2 Scuttlebutt episodes that featured Tobacco-Free Adagio Health. We had a wonderful representative come on to the podcast, talk to us about all the classes and therapies that they offer. It was 2 wonderful conversations, so I definitely direct you to both of those if you want more information, or just call their free quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Thank you again, Tobacco-Free Adagio Health, for your support.